your first partnership was as a songwriting team with Lou Adler. Is that right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we were friends. Lou was married to my ex-wife's girlfriend.
Oh, wow.
And that's how we met. And at that time, Lou was in the insurance business, and he was also selling men's clothes, and he sold me his policy of an insurance policy that I didn't need, and I had a feeling I liked this guy.
That's very funny. And you guys started A&M Records in your garage with $100 each. Is that actually the case?
Well, no, not with Lou Adler. Lou Adler and I worked with...
oh, that's right. Jerry Moss.
Keen Records with Sam Cooke, Bumps Blackwell, and learned a lot from the great Sam Cooke. Then when Lou and I left, we did, you know, a couple records with Jan and Dean, which were hits, and then we did this Alley Oop record. And then I left this... I was working at a gym at the time, and this guy said, you know, you look like you should be in the movies. So I took a little left turn and auditioned for the Ten Commandments, actually. And they said I wasn't ready for it, but you need to study. So I started studying acting, and I realized I wasn't really good at it. And I was studying with, you know, Leonard Nimoy at the time. This was before Star Trek.
Huh.
But that wasn't happening for me. And then I recorded for a major record company for about a year and a half. Got a lot of experience, negative experience from there, from that. And when I met Jerry Moss, we had plans to record a couple sides just as a flyer, because in those days, like in 1962, there were a lot of record companies just operating out of the trunks of their car. So we were, you know, we didn't have an office. We had my garage. We released this record, The Lonely Bull, and it became a big hit.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you mean, without taking any skeletons out of the closet, about negative experience with those other record companies? So that you learned when you had your own record company, I guess?
Yeah, well, when I was with this company, I was treated like a number. When I was recording, instead of saying Herb Alpert or anything like that, it was 427851, take two. You know?
Holy Moses.
Very impersonal. And then, you know, the recording studio itself was very cold. Not in temperature, but just the way it looked. I didn't feel, you know, creative in there. I didn't feel comfortable. And there was all white on white on white on white. And then I was listening to a playback of one of the songs I recorded, and I kind of liked it, but I felt it needed a little bit more bass, so I went over to the console and lifted the pot to create a little bit more bass sound, and the engineer actually slapped my hand and said, don't ever touch this again. This is a union board, and we can get in trouble, blah, blah, blah. And at that point, I thought to myself, man, isn't this supposed to revolve around the artist, you know, the record industry? And so I filed those things. I filed that whole feeling. And when we had our chance to develop our studios at A&M, I just made sure everyone was comfortable. You walk in the place and you felt good. And I think that makes for a more creative environment.
That's huge. I'm absolutely flabbergasted by that story. Thank you so much for sharing that. That because
sure.
And every artist needs to feel safe and have the right to express themselves creatively and pursue their vision. And that obviously was not the case.
Yeah, it was
with
not
those
the
guys.
Case.
So, hearkening back, you were talking about your first release, which was The Lonely Bull, right?
Right, The Lonely Bull, 1962. It was a reflection of my feelings about bullfighting, which I used to go to Tijuana in the spring and watch some of the great matadors of the world until I got to the point where I didn't like the sport anymore. I felt a little cruel. I saw a horse that got gored, and that was not a pleasant experience. From that point on, I lost interest, but there was a little brass band in the stands at these events that, you know, played, it wasn't a mariachi band, it was just a brass band that was announcing all the various events. So I got intrigued with that, and of course, the people with the bota bags drinking wine, and I was one of them. And, you know, I just had a feeling for that, the spectacle, which was the real reason I recorded this song, and my partner gave it the name The Lonely Bull. And what was so fortuitous about that, after that record became a huge hit, I got a letter from a lady in Germany, and she said, "Dear Mr. Alpert, I want to thank you for sending me on this vicarious trip to Tijuana." And at the time when I read it, I was thinking, well, that's humorous. But then I thought about it and said, wow, that music was so visual to this lady that it transported her. And I'm going to think about making, you know, visual music. I mean, not that I was trying to, organize with my creativity, but it's an important component in music. I think if it takes you someplace, it's a great feeling. Opposed to, you know, the music we hear in elevators, where, you know, some people call it, you know, elevator music, where it's not bad, it's not good, it's just there, and it doesn't conjure up anything. Mm-hmm. So, I was always looking for that feeling of taking it someplace.
It's the difference between aiming for neutral and making a statement.
right, exactly.
Now, the Lonely Bull was actually attributed to the Tijuana Brass, but that's not really the case, right? The Tijuana Brass didn't quite exist at that moment?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, no, it was just a fictitious name. My partner came up with it, and I was a little reluctant because I certainly didn't want to, you know, deceive anyone thinking that I was from Tijuana.
But you put that together yourself, right? It was really with Ampex tape, and I got this from your website that essentially it says here on your website, created by Herb Alpert on his Ampex tape recorder, overdubbing several tracks of himself playing multiple instruments.
Well, partly right. You know, it's when I heard Les Paul, that record he had in the late 50s of How High the Moon, where he was layering his guitar. He played on top of himself several times. I tried doing that in my little garage. I had two tape machines, and I went from one to the next and put the trumpet on, and I came up with this sound that it felt good to me, and that was the genesis of the Tijuana Brass sound.
And when did the Tijuana Brass become an actual group?
Well, it wasn't until after I recorded the Whipped Cream and Other Delights album. I got a traveling group, and things really started taking off after we had this record, The Taste of Honey.
Well, yeah. I mean, now you just jumped ahead past a whole bunch of your successes, it seems to me. But, yeah, of course, Taste of Honey and Whipped Cream and Other Delights, you had just a remarkable year in 1966.
Well, it was. Taste of Honey came out in 65, and that's when I got the group. And with the new group, I was playing at a club in Seattle, Washington. And we had released, my partner loved this record that I did called Third Man Theme. He was promoting that record, and Taste of Honey was on the other side as a B-side.
Huh.
And so every time I played Taste of Honey in concert at this little club in Seattle, people would go wild. And so I told, you know, I called my partner. I said, "Jerry, we're on the wrong side. I got a focus group here in Seattle, and it Taste of Honey is the side." He says, "Nah, man, you can't. It's too long. You can't dance to it. It stops in the middle." I said, "Well, whatever those elements are, I don't know, but turn it over, man, because I think Taste of Honey could be a record." Anyways, we finally turned it over, and 2 months later, it was a monster.
And won 4 Grammy Awards.
Yeah, it won, And that was the days when the Grammys were not that visible. You know, we that whole event was held at a hotel, no television. It was a great night for me. Got 3 or 4 Grammys that night, and I got to meet the great Louis Armstrong.
Oh, see, now you're talking anything goes language. Wow, that must have been, as a trumpet player, you must have really been beyond thrilled?
Well, I was beyond thrilled because Louis was really the guy that most great trumpet players listened to, because he pushed the envelope. You know, he was the guy that the way Louis was the way he sounded through the instrument. I got an opportunity to play with him in 1967. I was hosting the Kraft Music Hall, and Louis was on the show. And I interviewed him, and then we played "Hello, Dolly" together. But I was just watching him, his unpretentious way of being, and his personality and energy would come right through the instrument. And he was just a delight, man. I was, you know, at one point I said, Louis, I said, what do you? I know a lot of people call you Satchmo, but what do your friends call you? He said, Irving.
Okay.
Yeah, I know.
So he was just an artist and never got into the ego trip. I mean, I think
that's... Oh, man, this guy was special. He was uniquely special.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that as well, Herb. We really... these stories are unbelievably wonderful. The A&M grew bigger than you and Jerry ever envisioned, or did you guys really think, you know, let's start something? And I mean, did you just create it to release your own stuff, or what were you thinking at the time?
Yeah,
in the garage?
It was kind of seat of the pants operation. You know, we had this hit record, and then most of our distributors said, why don't you guys just take the money and run? You know, You got lucky with an instrumental because you guys are close to Tijuana, living in Los Angeles. And we kind of took that as a challenge and reinvested the money and recorded the Lonely Bull album, which did rather well. And then we just kept going with, recording the Tijuana Brass. And little by little, we started getting other artists. And so it started with my partner Jerry Moss and I in my garage. And then there were three, and then five, and 20, and then all of a sudden, you know, when we sold A&M, we had 500 people working for us around the world, and it was way more than I was comfortable with. You know, it started out as a real intimate setting where, yeah, I knew everyone. We'd have picnics, and we'd have, you know, really good times with our staff, and then all of a sudden, it got way out of hand where, I just didn't, I didn't know what... 3/4 of the people that were working for us.
Now, what was that like as an artist? Because most of us don't spend a whole lot of time in the left side of our brains, and here you were, the captain of a very large business ship. Do you consider yourself having a good business head?
No, I don't have a good business head. I'm 85% in the right side of my brain.
Okay, that makes sense.
I paint, I sculpt, and I play the horn every day of my life. And my partner, Jerry Moss, you know, was schooled with, he had a business sense, and he was handling most of the everyday big deals. And I took a back seat to that. But when it came time to the overall big decisions for the company, I was right with him, and we would make decisions together. But I remember we used to have these financial meetings with lawyers and accountants, and man, my eyes would glass over. It would put me to sleep. Not that I didn't want to know what was happening. It was just that it just didn't resonate with my brain.
I completely hear you.
Yeah.
In 1966, you guys launched Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66.
Right.
Right? And was that one of the first acts that you brought into A&M?
No. The first act was, we had George McKern, who was the bass singer with the Pilgrim Travelers. He was probably one of the first. We had another group called the Kenjalairs, and then we picked up a record by We Five, which was called You Are On My Mind, which became the number one record in the country.
Okay.
So we had that record, then Sergio, then Joe Cocker, and then Cat Stevens, and then then it just really opened up when Jerry took a trip to London, and we started getting these great English artists, and Peter Frampton, and you know, just one thing led to another. We weren't looking for the beat of the week. We were looking for, you know, artists that have something unique to say in their own special way. So when you hear the look at the A&M rock roster, you can see that, you know, with the Police and Cat Stevens and artists like that, Supertramp.
And when you wanted to bring the Carpenters on board, not everyone agreed with you. Is that correct?
Well, no. They couldn't disagree. I signed them. I heard this tape and I fell in love with Karen's voice. I thought it was uniquely special. And then when I met Richard and Karen, I realized that was the music that was just coming out of them so naturally, and wasn't the music that I normally listen to. More of a jazz artist, but I appreciated their authenticity. So I signed them, and it took a while for them to break through. And while they were not happening, I'd get a little flack from my own company, thinking, "Hey, these guys are a little soft. They didn't really, they're not what the radio is playing these days, or whatever they were coming up with." And then, luck be have it, I handed them a song called "Close to You."
And
they recorded it the first time, and Karen was playing drums. Because if you ask Karen, what's her strong suit, she says, "Well, I'm a drummer."
Right.
She thought she was a drummer. She was, an unbelievable singer. So they recorded it, and, I played it, and I said, "No, this is a little too soft. You need to pump it up a little bit." And they recorded it again, and then, no, it wasn't right. Third time was the charm. They got what they called the wrecking crew in those days, the guys that could put the beef on the burger. So they had a deep sound, and Hal Blaine on drums, and they recorded that for the third time, "Close to You," and that was the song that really opened the door wide for them. And it's another story how I got "Close to You," because I recorded that song as a follow-up to "This Guy's in Love with You."
That was going to be my next question, so fantastic.
Yeah, so I recorded that song because I, just had a feeling for it, and I thought it was a pretty good recording, and I was listening to the playback in the control room, and my friend Larry Levine, who was the engineer who did most of the Tijuana Brass records, looked at me and says, "Man, you sound terrible singing this song." So I lost my fastball, I put the song away, and then, in 1970, I gave it to Richard, and that was the one.
The Carpenters originally started playing jazz, right? They were a jazz group. So how did they end up? You brought them "Close to You," but at that time, that was almost inventing a genre with the Carpenters, it seems to me. That's a Paul Williams tune, right?
Paul Williams, you say?
Is that Paul Williams?
No, that's Burt Bacharach.
That's a Burt Bacharach. Okay, of course.
But no, they were not a jazz group. They're like a quasi-pop group. They had their own little niche, but it was more pop than jazz. And it was, interesting. It was the type of music that was just coming naturally out of them, and it was it appealed to me. I mean, her voice was special,
Oh, yes.
I learned a lot from the great Sam Cooke when Lou Adler and I were working with him, and I watched the way he auditioned artists, and I don't know if Sam rubbed off on me. I don't think Sam knew he was teaching, but he was magic, this guy. And I would audition all artists in a similar way. I'd close my eyes and listen to them, and if I got the buzz, I would get excited. If I didn't get the buzz and I opened my eyes and they were really handsome and they could dance, really well, it didn't matter to me. I was just listening to, as Sam would say, a cold piece of wax, and it either makes it or it don't.
A cold piece of wax.
Yeah, that's how Sam put it.
Very interesting. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
You chose to disband the Tijuana Brass in 1969.
Right.
Right. And at that time, you were having a little bit of trouble expressing yourself with your music. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was going through a real problem with the trumpet. I couldn't play. I mean, I could make a sort of a sound, but I was stuttering through the horn.
Ow.
It wasn't working. And I was going through a divorce. I was not in good shape emotionally. And it was really confusing for me because, you know, I had the American dream come true. I got the brass ring. I was selling a lot of records. All the things that you think about growing up, I thought I had it, except I was not happy. So I guess I didn't have it.
I guess that kind of success so quickly can be overwhelming. And so... You began painting to express yourself. Was that part of the process of healing from all that you've been through?
I didn't think of it quite like that, but yeah, I guess you're right. I did start painting. I started painting in 1970, mm-hmm. after traveling around the world and going to museums. I'd go to the modern art section, and for whatever reason, intrigued by abstract art. And I see a painting, a black painting with a purple dot, or a purple painting with a black dot, and I looked at it and saying, and it was hanging in the museums, thinking like, well, let me try that.
Uh-huh.
And so, I started moving painting around like a monkey, and I had a good time doing it, and, it was just something that I kept doing. I kept doing it day after day, and I had, it kind of evolved into, more dramatic stuff, and had a great time doing it. And then a couple art dealers saw it and wanted to show it. And I've had shows in Europe and Germany and Belgium and all different parts of the United States. So it's been great. I've been doing it for my own pleasure. If no one liked it, I'd still be doing it. And that's just the way art goes, I'm intrigued by the mystery of art. I think that's just the most fascinating thing. What makes something great to listen to? Why is Louis Armstrong? What is it about a Louis Armstrong solo that turns you on?
Oh, I can answer that. I can answer that for me.
What is it?
It's honesty.
Well,
emotional
absolutely
truth.
Honesty. But if you tried to analyze what he was doing, you're lost.
Yeah.
I mean, like Miles Davis, who we all adore as a musician. What the heck is that? We know he was honest. He wouldn't play a note that he didn't really want to play. But beyond that, what was the deal? Why is what he did so touching? And honesty, plays a big part in it. But you can't beyond that, because all great artists have to have that element. There's
mm-hmm.
nothing that. I don't think you can get away with anything less than being honest. You can get maybe a hit record or two with a great producer and some fancy footwork, but if you're going to have a long career, it has to have that Duke Ellington, Stan Getz, Thelonious Monk stuff,
Well, I could talk to you about this for a very, very long time, and at some point I hope to have the opportunity to. But I want to tell everybody, and I'd like you to speak about, you've got a show right now since we are going to be airing here in the New York Metro. You've got one at the ACA Gallery.
Oh, at the ACA Gallery. It's my second show. It's sculptures only. The ACA Gallery, I think they're on 20th Street. And it's really really a good show. I'm proud to be in that gallery because they've been going since 1932. Great history, great people involved. The Bergens have this gallery and they treat it with loving care. So it's a win-win for me.
Lovely. When you sculpt, what kind of things do you sculpt, Herb?
Well. You'd have to see it to believe it.
Okay, I'll be going.
Oh, well, at the gallery there's just some sculptures. But, right now at my studio, I'm doing these 18-foot totems.
Holy smokes. Oh, that's
yeah.
Right. Holy smokes.
And they're made of bronze, and they're interesting because, I started doing totems a few years back. It's not all what I do, but I saw this great show at It's Stanley Park in Vancouver, BC, the native upper northwest natives carved these fantastic totems. Some were like, you know, 60 feet up in the air, carved of wood. And I started doing that I started with the clay and then would turn into bronze. And my early sculptures were very symbolic of what they were doing. And then it struck me like music. I said, well, who wants to see that? They've already done it. And this is not a symbolic for me. I was just kind of copying them. And all of a sudden I started riffing on the whole thing and turning it into more of a jazz concept where it's just, you know, rhythms and shapes that turn me on. And that's what I've been doing.
Wow. But I've seen your painting. I like your coffee series very much. It looks like burlwood to me.
The coffees are good. I'm into this new thing now. I'm doing a jazz series. It's improv. It's called Jam Session.
Oh, and what's that?
It's just black and white, and they're, you know, like I said before, you can't identify. I can't identify, you know, anything that has to do with art. It's like, you know, standing in front of a Jackson Pollock painting and trying to figure out what the hell he was thinking, you know. You can't, you know. It's either you're going to get it or you're not. And the big turnoff is with, you know, trying to analyze something. Yeah, I don't think you can analyze art. You can just either accept it on the level it's being presented or, you know, just ain't going to happen. Yeah.
I agree with you there, and everybody is going to have a different reaction to a piece, and that's what makes it good.
Oh yeah, you kind of bring your own little personality into it. I don't really identify what I'm doing when people ask what was your motivation, because I see some things in my work, but I don't want to tell you because it might not be the same thing you're seeing, and I don't want to take away that that advantage.
That's neat. That's wonderful. Do you see? You said you play your trumpet every day. Is that
every day?
And do you also paint and sculpt every day?
Yeah, just about every day. There are days when I go into the paint studio and I don't have it. I seem like I'd be wasting my time trying to do something because there's something about that. There's a moment when creativity kind of just happens. You feel like whatever you touch is going to work. And sometimes I have a feeling whatever I touch is not going to work.
Do you trust that when that happens?
I definitely trust it.
Okay.
I trust it completely. Now, with music, it's a whole different thing because I'm playing concerts with a very small group behind me with you know, drums, bass, and keyboards. So it's very transparent. And the thing that keeps me going doing these concerts is that it's all spontaneous. You know, whatever we play on Monday is going to sound different on Tuesday because it's all improv. Except, you know, there's a form to it, but whatever happens inside the form, it's all off the cuff. Except I'll do a Tijuana Brass medley, which is pretty well, you know, it's kind of neat. My wife will do a medley of songs that when she was the lead singer with Sergio Mendes in Brazil 66. That's, you know, pretty well formed. But other than that, it's all off the cuff, and that's what makes it exciting for me night after night.
That's actually what you anticipated my next question yet again, because after all these years in the business, there has to be a reason if you hit the road and leave what I'm imagining is a wondrous oasis in Malibu.
You're absolutely right. It's not my favorite thing to pack and unpack.
Yeah.
But I certainly love to play. I get energy from it.
From the collaboration with the musicians or the audiences or both?
It's with the musicians. You know, we know each other really well. The group is very tight, and it's a fun listen to hear us. It's a great experience. It's a loving experience. I feel like if it's fun for me to play, it's going to be fun for some people to listen to, and I don't think anyone will be disappointed coming to see us.
I'm sure that that's the case. Is there anything about your playing when you're self-assessing yourself as a trumpeter that you like better now than some of the things that were some of the sounds that you were making when you were making your hits?
Well, you know, when I was making the Tijuana Brass music, it was pretty well formed, because in those days, you made records that lasted 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes the most. And it was, you know, you play the song and do whatever you do and call it a day. You know, now it's just everything has kind of opened up a lot more. And like I said, I'm basically a jazz musician at heart. I love, you know, all the great jazz musicians. And Stan Getz was a dear friend of mine, and I took some lessons from Stan. And I don't know. I love the art form. I think it's about freedom, and I think that's what we're all looking for. And I think that's what's happening in the Middle East. These people want freedom. And I saw something that was way mind-boggling. I played in Oslo, Norway, with this Latin group that I had at one time, and on the bill was Herbie Hancock and Michael Brecker, some of the great you know, jazzers. And it was outside. It was a festival. There were like hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people there. But the thing that got me was, I mean, it seemed like it was the people were a little, in my opinion, they seemed a little depressed at just being there at that time of year, the time when the sun went down around, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning. And I played with my group, and there was a nice reaction, and then Herbie got up there and started playing with Brecker, and people went crazy. They loved it. I mean, and Herbie Hancock was playing this stuff that was so far out I couldn't understand what the heck he was doing, you know. I mean, it was just, you know, really avant-garde stuff. I obviously did understand some of what he was up to, but my point that I'm trying to make is these people that were looking for that type of freedom, I think that's why jazz resonates with so many people. It's about freedom. It's about the willingness to, you know, be yourself, take a chance. And the great jazz musicians aren't playing the right stuff. They're looking for the right stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference. And the people picked up on it.
Well, I have to ask this question, even though I'm thank you so much. I hope you have a few more minutes, because I have a few other questions, and you're being so generous. But I'm in the middle of recording an album right now. I just want to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that, as somebody who's had a record label, and you're saying you're a jazz musician at heart, to me, the conflict is that there's so much technology now, and when you get a good take, and maybe there's a slight vibrato that's a little bit maybe taking it under the pitch, is how much do you go in and tamper with a good cut nowadays? And I just wonder how you
tamper at all.
Oh, see,
yeah, that ain't jazz. You know, the reason we like Miles and those great ones are they just let it fly, man. Let's face it. One of the great jazz musicians of all time, great singers, Billie Holiday. Now, was she singing perfect? Was she in tune? It doesn't matter, man. People are listening to the feel, and that's all there is. If it doesn't feel good, forget it.
Well.
And you can over-sanitize a record real easily these days, because you got, you know, ways to tune it up. You got ways to, you know, sanitize the record to a point where the heart is gone. And, you know, if you're listening for the incidentals, you're listening for the little bleeps here and there, you're listening for the wrong thing.
So, wow. Well, thank you. That's a very freeing thing you just told me, because you can't oversanitize.
It's not that easy. What you got to do, and I learned how to do this, and I give Sam Cooke some credit for teaching me this, but I learned how to listen to the overall feeling, and I don't listen to myself when I'm listening to a playback. I listen to how the thing overall feels. If it feels good, I stop. If it doesn't feel good, I can, you know, continue trying to make it to a place where I'm getting some buzz.
You don't listen to your own performance in isolation, is what you're saying. You're listening just for the groove of the entire track.
I'm listening for the, how does it feel good, the whole thing. You know, not just me. You can over-sanitize something to the point where it doesn't live. You know, the A&M Studios, used to, it was a custom studio, and we had these rock and rollers in there that were, recording. It's a famous group, and they were recording. There was just four guys, and they were recording for, a couple months there, and finally it was time to mix it down to stereo or, whatever they wanted to mix it to. And I was walking through the studio the day they started mixing. I said, man, this is going to be fun for you guys. You're going to finally mix it together. And they said, well, not really, because we have the drums on 40 tracks.
Oh,
I mean, I said, what the hell, man? What can you do on 40 tracks with a drum, So you get the point.
I do get the point. 40 tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, because mixing, it can either enhance or it can take all the joy out of the process.
Well, I think it takes it away. Yeah. I think, you can have umpteen thousand tracks these days digital, with zeros and ones. And it can work to your disadvantage. You think it's going to help you, it's going to hurt you. And, you listen to a lot of these fusion records. They're just so cute and neat, and the solos are perfect, and everything is so right there in place, and there's no sweat on it.
Hmm. Thank you for that tutelage. I really appreciate it. Let's talk about In the Mood, if you don't mind. It's your 41st album, Herb Alpert?
Geez, I don't know.
That's what Caroline told me, so I'm guessing it must be right.
Well, Caroline knows.
So tell us about In the Mood and what your inspiration was. How do you choose the tunes? And there are some arrangements on there that would be considered a little bit avant-garde. So how do you approach a recording after all of these years and after all of those albums?
I just pick on songs that I like. I think melodies are the ones that I always look for a good melody. Chattanooga Choo Choo is an interesting one for me because it's my nephew Randy Badass Alpert came up with this groove. I put Chattanooga Choo Choo over the top of it, and then I called on my friend Eddie Del Barrio to write some strings for it. And I think it's an interesting combination between electronics and my style of jazz and some more sophisticated strings. I think that those three elements make it really interesting. I'm very conscious of the lyrics, when I play.
Are you?
Oh, completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you listen to When Sunny Gets Blue, I'm right with the lyric. When Sunny gets blue, her eyes turn gray and cloudy.
Mm-hmm.
Then the rain begins to fall. You'll hear that through my horn. That's what I'm playing.
Okay, so you're inspired by the lyric as much as the musical notes on the page. Not everyone who is a musician does pay attention to the lyric in that way, but I think it most inspiring.
I think on a good song, the lyric plays an integral part of the song being a success.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your wife. You've been married since 1971 to Lanny Hall?
Yeah, we've been together for over 40 years. We've been married officially for 41. We've been together 45 years, 46 years. I met her, I auditioned Sergio Mendez in Brazil 66. In 1966, Lonnie was the lead singer. And, I produced the first few albums, especially that one that, was the breakthrough for them, where Mashki Nada came out of. And Fool on the Hill. And so I used to record Lonnie, she was the lead singer. And it was my idea to stack Lonnie's voice because she has an incredible, not only her voice is great, but her intent is perfect because she just sings. She's a soulful singer. You have to hear her in person to really recognize how great she is. She's a world-class singer. And so we became friends, and little by little, one thing led to another, and we became a duo.
So when you're not only together with your as a couple, but you've also collaborated creatively, and does that always work for you?
Oh yeah, I like to have creative people around me. I don't need to take all the credit. I got some great, you know, musician friends, creative people, and whatever they contribute is great. You know, I felt the same way at A&M. You know, like I said, I'm a 85% on the right side of my brain, and I loved to surround myself with, you know, smart people, and people that could do things that I couldn't or didn't have the desire to. That was, I think, part of the key.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. The less ego you can bring to any party, the more successful the venture is going to be. Can we talk a little bit about the Herb Alpert Foundation and how you began that and what your intention is in creating it?
I started that in 1982. I wanted to give back. I just felt like that was the natural thing to do. I was blessed beyond my dreams. And it was a little daunting at first because I realized, you know, I'm not the Ford Foundation or Rockefellers. You know, I just wanted to do something. I wanted to be smart with it. I wanted to make sure that we're, you know, supporting organizations that are doing wonderful things with kids, for one. I think having a creative component in a child's life is a key ingredient. I don't think you can have a full education without experiencing some form of creativity, dance, poetry, acting. It doesn't really matter as long as you can get that out. And so I would, you know, working with organizations that help kids along in that area without prejudice, that's one of my goals.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think through creativity, you kind of get a feeling for your own uniqueness if you stick with it. And if you can feel that you have something unique to say, then maybe you can appreciate others' uniqueness as well. And, I don't know if that's a lofty way of saying it, but I don't know, man. We're having a lot of problems, it seems like, at this particular time in history where empathy is not a high priority for a lot of people. And I think through the arts you get more in touch with that, and that's something that appeals to me. In fact, we're involved in a company, not a company, it's an organization in Berkeley, California. They're studying whether compassion can be taught, which is kind of an interesting subject for me. And, of course, the legacy of jazz. You know, this is the great American legacy of this amazing art form that's uniquely ours. And I've had the experience of meeting some of the great jazz musicians in my lifetime. And this is something that needs to continue on and be appreciated on a much grander level than it has been in the past. Stan Getz was a dear friend of mine, and he used to go to Europe, and it didn't matter whether he had a hit record or not. They'd lay out the red carpet for him. He'd get these honors in France and Italy and all parts of Europe, and he was just revered as a great jazz musician, as, you know, the others, as Louis Armstrong and Duke and so many others as well. But, you know, in this country, we just don't seem to have that same attitude about this music, and I think it has to do with our public school system. We're not teaching it. We're not teaching appreciation. And one of the reasons that motivated me is that when I was 8 years old, I had this opportunity in my grammar school to have a music appreciation class, and there was a table filled with instruments, and I was fortunate to pick up the trumpet. I tried to make a sound out of it, but, you know, really couldn't, and it took a while to make a sound out of it. But when I did make that sound, it was speaking for me because I was super shy. Huh. And this horn was just, you know, talking for me. So I'd like, you know, kids to have an experience like that.
That's huge. That's huge. I have to tell you that I have done work with, you know, inner city kids and brought creativity to them, and it's transformative. Even just a day's worth of improv and writing poetry and singing a song for themselves is incredibly empowering. So I'm sure you know that your work with the Herb Alpert Foundation is reverberating beyond your imagination, and I can tell you I've seen it firsthand. It's absolutely an amazing gift to give to these kids.
I sleep good at night. You know, I think we're really lucky to live in a country where free expression can flourish.
And you're turning 80 this year, so after that must, you know what? I hear you. Well, happy birthday, though. It's next month, right?
The 31st of March.
And so after all these years in the music business and on the planet, is there anything you'd like to share with aspiring musicians and with everyone else? Can you encapsulate it in words in any way?
Don't eat a bunch of junk.
Okay. That's one pearl of wisdom from Herb Alpert. What else you got?
I think, you know, you be passionate about what you're doing. I think that's the key to life. And you know, obviously, you need love in your life, and you need to have good friends and a great relationship if you can get there. But I think love is that great a component that makes things work. Hmm. Passion. If you're not passionate about, you know, being a musician, don't do it. It's tough out there. Whatever your goal is, if you're not doing it for the right reasons, I'd move on to the next. You know, make sure your education is up to par, because while you're sleeping, other people are practicing.
Absolutely. Well, and for every person that is talented, there's somebody who's willing, who's working really, really hard.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I'm wondering, would you be kind enough to record an ID or two for me to use on the air?
All right.
If you are uncomfortable with that, I understand that.
I'm not uncomfortable with it. I'm still here.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. If you just this is Herb Alpert, and you're listening to Anything Goes Radio, I would just jump through hoops.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Anytime, whenever you're ready, Michael's ready.
Hi, everyone. This is Herb Alpert, and you're listening to Anything Goes Radio, WFDU-FM.
Wow, what a good memory. Okay. I honestly, Herb, this has been such a privilege, and you have been so very generous. I feel very much impacted by the moments that we've had as an artist. More than anything, to just hear.
Great. Well, come by and see us, because Lonnie Hall will knock you out. She's that good.
I would love to. Is there a P.O. box or some way that I can get things to you, or should I?
Talk to Caroline. She's my conduit.
Okay, so if I come to the Bergen Pack, may I come backstage and meet you and say hello and all that?
Well, sure. Absolutely.
Okay. I mean, I asked about the Carlisle. I don't know if there's actually going to be space at the Carlisle gig.
Caroline would be the one to ask, you know.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. You've been incredibly generous, and this has really...
Oh, you're welcome. Good luck. Good luck at new recordings. Don't think too hard. It's all about feel.
Well, you know, it's hard. With all that darn technology out there and everybody, and my accompanist is a perfect pitch. He's making me a little nuts.
Oh, forget that, man. You got to get beyond that. The perfect pitch people can drive you crazy.
Okay, thank you.
They're listening. Some of them are listening to the wrong drummer.
Thank you so much. You've been incredibly generous. I really appreciate it.
Okay,
I look forward to actually seeing your face and feeling your energy. Thank you so much. And to you with the In the Mood tour.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.